I was telling you about what these we were talking about the two main very zeroth ordered big CD problems that we face today, which are brought onto us by trying to put together the ideas of quantum mechanics, relativity, and gravity together. We spent some time talking about how, because of gravity, space-time ceases to make sense at the Planck length and has to be replaced by another notion. And this is a very, very big problem. We'll come back to talk about it at greater length. It's a partially solved problem in some toy examples, but it's clear that the guts of the problem, the hardest part of it, has still not been completely understood. I want to say something quickly here. There are lots of naive ideas for what might happen when you say you get down to Planckian distances and space-time doesn't make sense anymore. Well, there's also very naive ideas you might have for what happens there. Like maybe there's atoms of space-time. Maybe there's some kind of discreteness down at very, very short distances at the Planck length. Maybe some kind of lattice. Ideas like that. All of these ideas are clearly wrong. And there's something much, much deeper and more interesting going on. We'll come back to talk about it at some length. I say they're clear. By the way, just throughout these lectures, I'm going to assert things to be true that other people will disagree with. That's a common and decent way of actually talking about things. If we stop at every moment to give every possible caveat to every comment we make, it would be hard to say anything without sounding like a lawyer all the time. So I'm going to do this a number of times. I'm going to assert things to be true. If you're skeptical about them, you should think about them and talk to other people. But anyway, this is something I say with 99.99999% confidence level. This idea of atoms of space-time, some kind of discreteness at short distance, is completely wrong. And is actually, it's much more interesting than that. If the solution looked something like that, it would be relatively boring. But it's actually much more interesting than that. What seems to be going on is the whole notion of the inside or the interior of a space-time doesn't make any sense. And the only thing we can talk about when we talk about gravity, fundamentally, is describing things in terms of what happens at the boundary of the space-time and not the interior of the space-time at all. This is a set of ideas that goes by the name of the holographic principle, and we'll come back to it. I'll talk about it. I'll tell you why this is the case, and we'll go through it at some length. But I just wanted to flag this right away. This is not some kind of this is as deep as it seems. It's even deeper than you might appreciate at first, because it's not like there's some kind of little stupid discreteness at short distances. Amongst other things, some kind of discreteness at short distances is an incredible conflict with the idea of special relativity. In what frame of reference would you have a little lattice? The lattice would look different in different frames of reference. We couldn't have some lattice structure down at Planckian distances. In some other frame of reference, Planckian distances might look much, much larger. It's very hard to talk about some sort of discrete lattice structure compatible with the ideas of special relativity. And that's why people who talk about this sort of discrete lattice structure often are very happy to do away with special relativity. But the theme of at least my lectures here is that we hold on to every old idea. The old ideas are never wrong. They just get more powerful. They get more constrained. We don't lose constraints. We gain them as we learn more and more. And that's the radical conservative philosophy that we're going to pursue. Anyway, the examples where we actually understand how space-time is replaced, at least partially, there are at least cases where we understand how space arises out of nothing. are definitely not, do not conform to the idea of some kind of atoms of space-time. Instead, they go very much along the lines of this much deeper and radically different way of thinking of what space-time might be. So anyway, we'll come back and discuss that at length, but I just wanted you to know this is not some dumb little thing. This is actually something quite deep. The other problems that I talked about had to do with these enormous hierarchies. The existence of the macroscopic universe that I said was somehow in incredible conflict with the idea of large, violent quantum vacuum fluctuations that would seem to give rise to enormous energy densities that would make it impossible for any macroscopic universe to exist. So that's the qualitative question: is how is it possible in a world with gigantic short distance quantum fluctuations for there to be any sort of macroscopic order at all? And what I just want to spend 5 minutes quantifying that a little bit, just so you see the sort of estimate that leads to the problem. So let's imagine putting the universe in a big box. Of side length L, okay? Now every particle in the world, so let's talk about the photon, for example, okay? Photons, well, we can have many different particle in a box wavelengths for the photons in this box, right? I can have a photon of that wavelength in many directions, right? All right, now, we'll get to this when we talk about quantum field theory, but at the moment, what I'm about to say is very reasonable. Each one of these photons, if you think about all the possible states that you can have, I can have one photon with that frequency, two photons with that frequency, three photons with that frequency. The energies would be h bar omega at that frequency. If there's one photon, 2h bar omega. If there's two photons, 3h bar omega. If there's three photons, and so on. So with every given frequency mode, I can think that there's a harmonic oscillator associated with that frequency mode with the corresponding frequency omega. All the energy levels I can have, the n mode of that harmonic oscillator would correspond to a state with n photons. So this is a very basic equivalence that you can think about. You can think about the excitations of any field like electromagnetism. You can think about each particle in a box mode, and associated with every mode is a harmonic oscillator. Okay. And it's a harmonic oscillator because in this case the particles are bosons, and we can make states with any number of them stacked on top of each other, and the energies are simply additive. Okay, so at some zeroth order approximation, we ignore all interactions and everything like that. You can think of the Hamiltonian that describes photons as just being a whole stack of harmonic oscillators, a different harmonic oscillator for every frequency mode that you can have in here. Okay, so that's something that you'll see in more detail, but for the moment, that's all we need. So in other words, if you like, the modes are labeled by three integers, n, x, n, y, and n, z. There are momenta, k's, associated with them, a k vector, so this is what labels the modes. I can also label them by the momenta, which would be n, x over l, n, y over l, and z over l. Okay? Just like your standard particle in a box, there's no, I'm forgetting pi's and stuff like that. Okay, so and what would the frequency be associated with this? The energy or the frequency? We just talked about photons that are massless, but in general, if the particles have mass m, the energy would just be given by e squared equals p squared plus m squared. So omega squared equals k squared plus m squared. You see, I'm freely interchangeably going back between omega, e, k, p. Okay, so these are all have exactly the same units. All right. So, but let's call it omega. So omega would be the square root of k squared plus m squared for whatever the particle is. Okay. That's just the E equals root P squared plus M squared. Okay, so the Hamiltonian that would describe a particle of mass M, a boson of mass M in the universe, is just the sum of a whole bunch of harmonic oscillators labeled by these integers, or equivalently labeled by all these K vectors. Okay? And so there's a separate harmonic oscillator associated with each and every one of these guys. Alright. I hope it's clear that if I want to describe a particular state that has N1 photons of moving with this K, and N2 photons moving with some other K, and 3 photons moving with some other K, then it's just some particular state where the N1 harmonic oscillator is excited, where each harmonic oscillator is excited up to however many, up to the corresponding energy level that goes with however many photons, let's say, I'm populating in each one of those states. All right, so, but that's not actually what we're interested in at the moment. We're interested in actually figuring out what the energy of the vacuum is. Okay? And that's associated with the fact that there is a half h bar omega, zero-point energy, associated with every single one of these harmonic oscillators. So let's add up all of those half h bar omegas. So that's the energy of the vacuum. Would be the sum over all of these n's of a half h bar omega. We're putting h bar to 1, so it's a half times k squared plus m squared. Okay? Now, as usual, you imagine the box is very, very big, and we should be able to replace the sum over all the n's by an integral. And in fact, we can replace the sum over n by an integral over k. Now, k has units, right? K has units of, yes.
Is there a question?
Yes, sorry.
I'm sorry, could you move that?
Oh, the blackboard.
Thank you.
Is that okay?
Yes.
I hope there isn't anything back. So we can replace the sum over n by an integral over k. The units are off here, right? The sum over n is dimensionless. The integral over k is dimension full. What makes up the units? It's just L is all we have, right? So it's L cubed times the integral d cubed k, 1 half root k squared plus m squared. That's the energy of the vacuum. That's very nice because the energy of the vacuum is proportional to the volume of the box. So that's good because what we should expect that we're talking about an energy density. So if we talk about the energy density of the vacuum, E vac, which is the energy over the volume, is then something which makes sense. Dimensionally, it's d cubed k, a half root k squared plus m squared. Okay? This has units of what? K has units of mass. So d cubed k is units of mass cubed. That has units of mass. This whole thing has units of mass to the fourth, which is the correct units for an energy density. Okay. So that's the formula for the energy of the vacuum, the energy density of the vacuum, just coming from the vacuum fluctuations of each one of these harmonic oscillator modes. Let's write this again. E vac is the integral d cubed k. I just put the half there so we remember k from a half inch bar. I'm not keeping track of any other factors. Okay, very good. So let's try to do this integral. Up to some 4 pi's that I forget, we can replace that by just a dk k squared. And then we have our half root k squared plus m squared. Now this is an integral from 0 to infinity, apparently. Okay, so what is this integral? Very badly infinity. Okay? Integral is very badly infinity. Now, where is that infinity coming from? That infinity is coming from very, very big k. Very, very big k corresponds to very, very short distances. Right? So this is an ultraviolet, so-called ultraviolet divergence. It is a power divergence, right? It's diverging like a power as we go to very, very short distances. Well, we just finished talking about this whole song and dance that we can't talk about distances smaller than the Planck length, et cetera, space-time breaks down. So clearly, this whole approximation to what we're talking about is actually a very poor one when K max, when the upper end of this integration starts approaching M Planck. Okay? When K becomes comparable to M Planck, this whole thing doesn't make any sense. Okay? We have really no idea what we are talking about. The whole picture of space-time and everything is breaking down. But let's get an idea of what this looks like by just writing it as putting a K max there, keeping in mind that we can't make K max bigger than M Planck for sure. Let's put a K max there and actually try to do this integral. Okay. Well, what are we going to get? There's a leading piece here that goes like K max to the fourth. Okay. Because a very big K, I can that goes like K squared. That goes like K. So it goes like dk k cubed, so it goes like k max to the fourth. Okay. Now, you can expand the square root. When k is much, much larger than m, we can expand the square root. Okay. And so there's a subleading piece. The leading piece goes like dk k cubed. The subleading piece goes like dk k. You see what I'm saying? So I can write that as k cubed square root of 1 plus m squared over k squared. And when k squared is much bigger than m squared, it's a good idea to expand this as k cubed plus m squared k plus m squared over m to the fourth over k plus dot, dot, dot. I'm just doing a Taylor expansion of the square root. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay, so the leading piece goes like k max to the fourth. There's a subleading piece that's still power divergent. Goes like m squared k max squared. You might say, why the heck would we care about this given that one? We'll talk about it in a second. And finally, there's an interesting piece that goes like m to the fourth. But what is that integral? That integral is an integral dk over k. Now, dk over k is still divergent, but it's only logarithmically divergent. So if I put a k max up there, and this whole approximation only made sense when k was much bigger than m, so this whole thing is going like log k max over m. And then I have plus other things. So this is the first encounter with some of these famous divergences that you run into in quantum field theory. One of the slogans, I promise you many slogans, so here's one of them. Infinities are your friend. Infinities are not bad, far from it. Infinities are awesome. Infinities are your tremendous friend. In fact, there's a more refined statement. Logarithmic infinities are your best friends. Okay? If you see logs, you should be so happy. Your heart should flutter. You should get extremely excited that something good is going to happen. Okay? This is really very unlike. So the standard thing that's still said in some older books is that infinities were this terrible thing. People have to invent these crazy mechanisms for sweeping them under the rug, and it's completely wrong. They're not swept under the rug at all. They're beautiful. They're in our face. We understand them, and they really help us focus on and understand correctly the physics. The reason is very simple. When something is becoming infinite, it's becoming much more important than other things. And that's very good, because it allows you to focus on what's important rather than inessential details. However, the real statement is that logarithmic infinities are your friend. These power infinities are not your friend. But let's talk about them. Let's talk about this a little bit. Okay. Anyway, this is the answer. Now, Right here, this is what we talked about a little bit qualitatively yesterday. That's the piece that says there's a gigantic energy density in the vacuum because there's more and more violent fluctuations down at shorter and shorter distances. That's the piece that we could have figured out purely on dimensional analysis. Okay. This is also the piece that that if there wasn't any gravity, it wouldn't matter. If there isn't any gravity, the overall energy density doesn't matter. It's not observable. But as I said, when there is gravity, even the overall energy density matters. Okay. And in fact, we'll talk about how vacuum energy leads to an accelerated universe and so on a little later. But for the moment, let's just say that if this Kmax went all the way up to the Planck scale, what we said yesterday holds. Clearly, we would get curvature of space and time that would be curved at the Planck scale, which is totally wrong. It looks nothing like our universe, where it's curved on very, very macroscopic macroscopic scales, like 10 billion light years, which is how big the observable universe is. Okay. So that's the first big problem here. In the presence of gravity, that gigantic energy density would just curve up the universe to be to look absolutely nothing like the world we see. Actually, let me just spend a second saying this in a little bit more detail. So even without talking about GR, we can get some idea of what some energy density in the world does to the universe. It curves the universe. Okay. We get some curvature. And if we think about distributions of matter or energy that are totally uniform, they're not clumps like stars and planets, but are totally uniform, then these totally uniform distributions of mass or energy are going to give rise to some curvature of the universe as a whole. Okay? So that's what gives us the equations that tell us the rate at which the universe is expanding. Okay? So it tells us something about the overall size, R of T, of the universe as a function of time. And we don't have to write down, we don't have to this happens very often when you talk about GR, that when you think very simple Newtonian thoughts, even though the actual physics is wrong, because you're basically doing dimensional analysis, you're going to more or less get the correct equations. So we're going to do that just to get the correct equations. The interpretation, the Newtonian interpretation, is totally wrong. We'll come back and talk about the correct relativistic interpretation. But if we think about the universe at some time as being given by having some radius r, and you can think about how far out you can see the horizon of the universe as being given by the place where the escape velocity from there would be of order 1, would be of order the speed of light, then we can get some idea about we can get an equation for we can get an equation for the rate at which the universe is expanding. And it's basically writing the equation that a half mv squared, it's writing the escape velocity equation. Okay? So if we say that if we think about r dot as the velocity, we say that r dot squared is comparable to g times the mass inside this region over r, and the mass inside that region is g newton times rho r cubed over r. So we get an equation that's r dot over r squared is equal to g newton rho. Okay. So that's and that ends up being the right equation for the rate at which the universe expands if there's some energy density rho. Okay. So we got it from this Newtonian heuristic, but it ends up being the correct equation. The so-called Friedman-Robinson-Walker equation. Anyway, so I'm writing this down just so we can see in a little bit more detail what the problem is if we have a vacuum energy density. Actually, before we do that, let's ask another question. Let's say the universe was just filled with dust, ordinary matter. Okay? If there's ordinary matter, then as the universe expands, the mass, each individual particle's mass isn't changing, but the universe is, if it's, the universe doubles in size, then the energy density is going down by a factor of 8. Right? The mass isn't changing, but the universe has gotten 8 times bigger in volume after it doubles in size, so the density is dropping by a factor of 8. So if the universe is filled with matter or dust, then rho itself depends on r, and rho matter times r cubed is a constant. So we get an equation that looks like r dot squared over r squared goes like g Newton times some constant over r cubed. Okay. And that's fine. You can try to solve, you can, yes?
So are you assuming that r dot is constant?
No, I'm not assuming r dot is constant. This is the equation that tells us what r dot is. Given some distribution of energy, given some rho, this is the equation that tells you the rate at which the universe is expanding. Okay. So, but here, so it doesn't matter how fast it's expanding. If it's filled with matter or radiation, as we'll see, all that matters is that as the universe gets bigger, the density dilutes, right? So it's, I have the same number of particles, but the universe is r grew by a factor of 2. The volume grows by a factor of 8, so the energy density drops by a factor of 8. So rho as a function of r is not a constant if the universe is filled with just mass. Okay? Rho as a function of r drops like 1 over r cubed. And you can solve this equation, and you can easily see that r double dot is negative. Okay? So the universe is decelerating. Radiation is actually even a little more interesting. If you have a single photon, then as the universe expands, that photon actually also gets stretched. So not only is the number density of the photons dropping, but the energy of each individual photon is also going down. So the energy density in radiation not only doesn't just go like 1 over r cubed, it goes like 1 over r to the fourth. Okay? So that's even more decelerating. Okay. Yes?
Where does the energy of the photon go?
Right. This is... perhaps we can have a discussion about this later, but energy is not conserved in cosmology.
Yeah.
Isn't conserved.
Energy momentum tensor is conserved, right?
No, nothing is conserved.
Oh.
There is some very silly sense in which you could say the energy is going into making the universe expand. But it's a useless sense of energy conservation. You have energy conservation when some system has time translational invariance as a consequence of Noether's theorem.
Yeah.
An expanding universe, globally, there's just no time translational invariance and no conserved energy. Okay. So there just isn't conservation of energy. Conservation of energy is a statement that's... conservation of energy is a useful approximate statement in systems which are approximately time translational invariant. But for the universe as a whole, it just simply does not hold. Okay. So that's... if that sounds confusing, we can talk about it at greater length. But anyway, so I'm not going through this in detail, but I just want to say, in matter or radiation, the universe would decelerate as it expands. That makes sense because, as you see, r dot squared scales like 1 over r or 1 over r squared. As r gets bigger, r dot slows down. Okay, so as the universe gets bigger and bigger, just the expansion velocity is slowing down. So it's decelerating. Contrast that with another situation, though. Let's say we have an energy density of the vacuum. If we have an energy density of the vacuum, then rho for the vacuum is just a constant. That's the whole point. It's the energy density of the vacuum. And so then we get an interesting situation. We get an equation that's r dot over r is just square root of g Newton rho vacuum, and we can all solve this equation and find that r is some r naught e to the square root g Newton rho vac t. The universe is expanding exponentially if it's dominated by vacuum energy. Okay. That means that the rate of expansion is increasing rather than decreasing as time goes on. The universe is expanding exponentially. That means that for any given point, from this point, as you go further and further out, things are receding from us at a faster and faster velocity until eventually, at some point, they're receding faster than light. And beyond that point, we can't see anything. So this is an extremely strange picture of the universe. The space is called the Sitter space. We'll talk about it probably in the last lecture. But I just want to flag it now so you see what a constant vacuum energy would do. A constant vacuum energy would make the universe expand exponentially. It would cause an accelerated expansion. Okay? Now, I told you that that what people found in 1997 was that there is evidence that the universe is expanding exponentially. Now, relatively recently. And that means that while over most of the history of the universe, depends what you mean by most, but in the early phases of the universe, the energy was dominated by radiation and matter and other things like that. Relatively recently, in the past few billion years, relatively recently on the log scale, it's been dominated by vacuum energy. That's the simplest explanation. But the value of the vacuum energy that you need, well, the value of vacuum energy that you need is such that the square root of g Newton rho from here is about 1 over 10 billion years. Right? Because the doubling time, the e-folding time is around 10 billion years, right? Around the around the current age of the universe. So we have to have the square root g Newton rho back to be around 1 over 10 to the 10 years. Okay? So you can use your nice dimensional analysis skills from yesterday to figure out what rho back has got to be consistent with that. And rho back needs to be around 10 to the minus 3 electron volts to the fourth. Some energy to the fourth, and that energy scale is 10 to the minus 3 electron volt. So that's the puzzle that I alluded to yesterday. First of all, this vacuum energy seems to be there, and the presence of gravity would make the universe accelerate like hell. If rho was near the Planck scale, the universe would want to be doubling in size every 10 to the minus 43 seconds. Okay? Instead, it seems that recently it's doubling in size every 10 to the 10 billion years. Before we knew it was accelerating, there was a fantasy that some deep principle we hadn't thought of yet would make this vacuum energy exactly zero. But after we find that it's accelerating, it's very hard to conform to that fantasy anymore. And somehow we have to understand why this quantity is not exactly zero, but is that minuscule size, which your famous dimensional analysis skills can also show to be 10 to the minus 120 in units of the Planck scale. So our back of the envelope estimate would have given us rho back of order m Planck to the fourth. If I put k max to be around m Planck, then I would get around m Planck to the fourth. That gets me the doubling time wrong by a lot, and the inferred vacuum energy is wrong by 120 orders of magnitude. So what do we have to do? That's what I mentioned yesterday. What we do is we cancel two quantities against each other to the accuracy of 120 decimal places, and we call it a day. But that's clearly very, there's something deeply wrong with that. Or it's telling us a very, very big clue about some zeroth order property of the universe that we need to understand. Okay. And this is not coming from some fancy, abstruse thing. This is just the most basic consequence of quantum mechanics, relativity, you put them together, you have these zero-point energies you have to talk about, they're there, and why the heck aren't they curving the universe like that? Now, I wrote this other one down because in the subleading problem gives rise to a major puzzle. This would take a little bit longer to explain, but it has to do with the fact that in our understanding of the standard model of all of the interactions, the standard theory of the interactions, the masses of many of the elementary particles are actually determined by the interaction of these elementary particles with some other field, so-called Higgs field. And this contribution to the energy indirectly gives a big contribution to the to the potential energy associated with the Higgs field itself. And that makes it very, very difficult to understand why it is. Once again, if Kmax is an order of the Planck scale, all the scales involved in this problem should be near the Planck scale. And it makes it very, very hard to understand why the weak length scale ended up being 17 orders of magnitude larger, 16 orders of magnitude larger than the Planck length scale. That turns out to be another fine-tuning problem, a fine-tuning problem of order. The Kmax here is of order hundreds of GeV, or a TeV. Thousands of GeV is a TeV. So the Kmax here is a TeV relative to the Planck scale. That's a fine-tuning of a measly 1 part in 10 to the 30 compared to the 1 part in 10 to the 120, but it's still a very significant problem. Finally, there is this guy, and we'll have a lot more to say about, we'll have some more things to say about these logarithmic divergences, but let me just make a comment here to tell you a little bit more why I was telling you that these logarithmics are your friend. These power divergences, you see, are completely dominated by what's going on at the shortest possible distances. We're doing an estimate. We're finding that something is power divergent. That means it is completely dominated by what's going on right where we don't know exactly what the physics is, right? So these power divergences are really telling you, don't press this whole calculation. We can't really do an honest calculation, right? Because everything is getting completely dominated right near where we don't really know what's going on. When you see a power divergence, it's just telling you there is a parameter in the theory you should be talking about. You should be talking about a vacuum energy, and its natural size should be gigantic. But this is not a reliable way of calculating it. There's just something sitting there which some more complete theory would tell you what it is, but this low energy way of trying to calculate it isn't going to get you the answer accurate. Okay? In other words, you might imagine as I go to higher energies, I see more and more particles, different species of particles, and so on. They would all contribute to this answer, and I would need to know what they are if I wanted to get the answer precisely. It gives me a rough estimate for how big it should be, but I can't get anything precisely from it. These power divergences are simply reflecting our ignorance about what's going on at incredibly short distances, and are dominated by what's going on there. Log divergences are very different beasts. A log divergence is log divergent because it gets equal contributions from all length scales. Okay. The integral dt over t gets equal contributions from every decade in t, every decade in k. Okay. It's something that knows that's actually completely computable just knowing what's going on at long distances. The precise coefficient of how it gets cut off at the top, is it log k max or 2k max or half k max? Okay, maybe that you need to know exactly what's going on near the top. But the coefficient of the logarithm, actually what's logarithmically enhanced, is totally under your control. It tells you a lot about the physics. In fact, the fact that you get quantities that receive equal contributions from all length scales when you do any calculation is telling you that there's a better way of setting up the calculation where you try to solve a differential equation, where you try to move from one length scale to another length scale to another length scale gradually, rather than just trying to do a whole calculation in one go. See, this computation that we're doing, ignoring all of this stuff, just summing up the vacuum energies, is all of a sudden gives us a whole big log, right? We just got it in one go. But the fact that we got that is telling us that there's some quantity that's getting equal contributions from all scales. And there's a more careful and a better way of thinking about it, where you think about physics one scale at a time and gradually take into account the effect of physics from one scale, 5 times lower, 5 times lower, 5 times lower, e times lower, whatever. And you do it gradually. That gradual way of moving scales is known as the renormalization group and is the deepest thing that we learned about quantum field theory in the 60s and 70s, really invented and explained beautifully by Ken Wilson. And anyway, but the sort of harbinger of that entire way of thinking about things, what tells you that it's going to be relevant, is the second you see logs in any calculation. You see any computation, you see logs in it, instantly you should be thinking about renormalization group equations, you should be wheeling out all this machinery, which you will learn in due course. But far from these logs telling you that there's infinities, you're sweeping under the rug, there's something wrong, it's exactly the opposite. These are deeply, deeply physical important things. and they ultimately tell us the best way of thinking about well, field theory, statistical mechanics, many, many other things. All right, but anyway, that's I don't want to spend too much time talking about that. I was mainly trying to go through this argument so you saw in more detail what the problem was, okay, and where this number 10 to the minus 120 comes from. So, okay. All right, so that wraps up our quick overview of the major crises in the subject. Space-time is doomed, and it's completely unclear why a macroscopic universe exists.
Just a question.
Yes.
That last logarithmic term, what kind of vacuum energy does it correspond to? It's more or less about.
Well, the reason it ends up corresponding to more interesting things is because of what I just quickly alluded to, that while here we did the calculation assuming the masses were a constant, in a little bit more detail, the masses themselves depend on the value of some other field. So this is really to be thought of as some correction for the potential energy for that other field. It's not very important for our argument right now, but I'd be happy to describe that in more detail for anyone who's interested. Okay. So that's the tour of the problems. So now I'm going to try to at least to now go through and explain what the issues are in more detail. And as I said yesterday, I can't give a whole series of a whole course on relativity, GR, quantum field theory, and all the things that you need in order to get up to the frontier and understand how to attack these problems. But I want to tell you enough and sort of give you highlights as we go along of a number of things so you can at least appreciate the logical structure of what the arguments are that get us, how we get here, how we got here, the right way of thinking about putting together quantum mechanics and relativity, and a little more sharply posed what these problems are. What the space-time and doom problem is, what these cosmological constant and hierarchy problems are, and what the solutions might be, what the approaches are for thinking about them, and in some cases, what the experimental consequences are that we might be looking for this decade. So in order to do this, we need to basically do a lightning review of 100 years of modern physics. And my plan is to do it in the following way. I want to talk a little bit about first relativity, then quantum mechanics. So you guys all in principle know relativity and quantum mechanics, but I want to highlight particular ways of thinking about issues in both cases that are going to be useful later. Then we'll talk about the synthesis of the two. We'll talk about what it takes to put relativity and quantum mechanics together. And I will go through the argument, at least I'll tell you the logical structure of the argument, why the only way of putting relativity and quantum mechanics together is quantum field theory. Okay? The normal way you talk about, one talks about quantum field theory in many books, is to say, well, we have things like Maxwell's equations that are fields, let's quantize them. Okay? And this is actually the entire approach to a quantization in most books, and certainly the way you guys learned it. We all learn it as undergraduates, that there's those classical systems, and then you quantize them. Okay. Of course, this is totally backwards. The world isn't classical, the world is quantum mechanical. Okay. So in fact, quantum mechanics is primary, and classical physics descends from it in certain limits. Okay. So the logic that there's classical fields, so we should quantize them. It's actually, I mean, it was a way people got started, but there's something a little loomy about it. The world is quantum mechanical. We should come up with an intrinsically quantum explanation for why we're doing what we're doing without having to refer to any underlying classical system. In fact, this is one of the really remarkable things that's been discovered in theoretical physics in the last 20 years, is we now have many examples of systems, really things that came out of many different limits of string theory, which are intrinsically quantum mechanical. Some of them don't have any classical limits at all. They're intrinsically quantum systems where there's no classical limit that you can say, ah, I'm quantizing that classical theory. Okay. Sometimes, even more interestingly or equally interesting, there are situations where you have one quantum theory and it has several classical limits. There are many different classical theories that are actually secretly the same theory, the same quantum theory. They appear different. If I describe them classically, I would give you a different Lagrangian or a different Hamiltonian. And you would think, oh, these are very different theories. But in fact, they're identical. When you quantize them, you find the theories are identical. So there's more and more evidence of something that's sort of generally obvious, that the quantum mechanics is primary. We shouldn't prejudge and say that we're doing something with classical motivations. It doesn't make sense. The world is quantum mechanical. So in fact, and also, the logic that we should quantize fields because there's classical fields like E and M also breaks down for other situations. What about electrons? Okay, there's no classical electron field, and yet ultimately we do quantum field theory with electron fields. Okay, so there the logic wasn't quantizing something that was already there. And there are even other more confusing situations. If you think about things like gluons in the theory of strong interactions, we don't even see gluons in quarks as asymptotic states. They're all confined inside protons and neutrons. So we're not quantizing them, and yet we write down the theory of quantum field theory that is quarks and gluons. So what the heck are we doing? Okay. This whole logic that you quantize classical things is just wrong. The world is quantum mechanical. Classical mechanics is a limit of it. And actually, either later today or tomorrow, we'll actually talk in some depth about how classical physics emerges from the quantum world, which is also a much more interesting subject than may appear at first. But anyway, this is all just to say that we don't do quantum field theory because there are fields out there classically and we quantize them. It's the other way around. It turns out that the only way of putting quantum mechanics and relativity together is the structure of quantum field theory. The reason fields come out, it turns out, this is what I'll spend some time describing, is if you want to, there's no such thing as waves, there's no such thing as fields fundamentally at all. Okay? There's no wave-particle duality, there's no fields and particles, there's just particles in nature. Particles are king, and we'll see very specifically why this is the case. What we're trying to do is come up with a theory that describes the interaction between particles. Okay, that's what we want to do. And we want to keep manifest two important physical properties. One, the interactions between particles are local. Okay, so there's locality in space-time. We want to keep quantum mechanics manifest, unitarity manifest, and we want to keep the interaction, the locality of the interactions manifest. It turns out that if you want to build the Hamiltonian out of particles, okay, you want to have interaction between particles, but if you want to do it in such a way that allows locality to be manifest, this is independent of special relativity even. If you just want to talk about a Hamiltonian for interactions of particles, in a way that keeps locality manifest, the best way of doing that is to group the particles together into fields. Okay. So the reason fields come out is because they give us an incredibly convenient way of talking about the interactions between underlying particles in a way that makes locality manifest. In fact, this is even useful in statistical physics, or any many-body situation where you have interactions of lots and lots of particles. If you don't want to write down a big many-particle Schrodinger equation, there's a totally equivalent way of talking about standard quantum mechanics with n particles in a way that groups the particles into fields and treats it as a quantum field theory. In a Lorentz invariant theory, when there's special relativity, this becomes much more urgent because particle number isn't conserved in interactions. We can produce particles and antiparticles. So we can't have a standard quantum mechanics with a fixed number of particles because it's possible to produce particles and antiparticles out of collisions if there's energy. Okay? So even particle number isn't conserved, and so it's really crucial to use this field idea because it allows us even in those situations to talk about putting particles talk about the interaction between particles in a way that's local. So that's why quantum field theory exists. It exists because it's a unique way of talking about the interactions of particles in a way that's Lorentz invariant and unitary. So that keeps the basic principle of manifest. And it turns out that all of these things that I talked about, the existence of antiparticles, the connection between spin and statistics, is just a direct consequence of following your nose and trying to make sure that these principles are kept. And even further things that I mentioned yesterday, the fact that once you start having massless particles of spin 1 and spin 2, they're forced to be described by amazingly special theories. Yang-Mills theory and general relativity is just a consequence of quantum mechanics and relativity, special relativity. Okay? There is these deep things like the principle of equivalence. It's not some principle from now that we know things better. Isn't there's other worlds which would be less beautiful where the principle of equivalence wasn't satisfied? No, just impossible. Quantum mechanics and relativity force the principle of equivalence. There's nothing you can do about it. There's simply no choice. General relativity, there's no choice. At sufficiently long distances, anything that describes massless spin 2 particles will look like general relativity. If these things are completely nailed, there's nothing you can do about it. That's what I want to So I will be able to talk about it enough so you see the logical structure of this entire set of arguments. But what I want you to get out of it is a remarkable feeling about how incredibly constrained the world is. Okay? The very existence of quantum mechanics and relativity basically completely nails what the description of physics can look like at sufficiently long distances, where we can ignore all of the crises that I talked about before. Okay? But if you're talking about distances long compared to the Planck length, then what the world can look like is just nailed. There's very little we can do about it. We know the basic structure of what it can look like as a basic consequence of relativity and quantum mechanics. So that's the plan. That's what I want you to understand. And then after we understand that, we can go back to these problems and at least phrase them in a somewhat more mature way and talk about what some of the plans of attack are. But in order to set it up, I need to tell you, and also to, in order not to set this up, but also set up talking about what the problems are, we need to talk about the two basic things, relativity and quantum mechanics, first. Okay? And just establish a common language and establish some good ways of thinking about it. So we'll start now with relativity. So let's start with special relativity. Okay, so so special relativity really means talking about Lorentz invariants. And as you all know, if I have some events in spacetime labeled by T and X, Lorentz invariance tells us that observers moving in boosted reference frames will ascribe different t's and x's to that same event, but the t prime x prime t and x in one frame would be t prime and x prime in another frame, but t squared minus x squared would be conserved. There's an invariant distance, notion of distance, which is t squared minus x squared. So the set of transformations, this is just in one plus one dimensions. Okay? So the set of transformations that leave t squared minus x squared invariant are the Lorentz transformations. Okay? Lorentz transformations are the transformations, linear transformations on t and x that leave t squared minus x squared invariant. Just so I calibrate, is this all familiar to everybody? Okay. Now, let's actually go back and talk about an even more familiar version of the same thing, which is just standard rotations in two dimensions. Okay, so this is the analogy that I'm sure you all know. But the analogy is that if we have, so, so this is what we were saying yesterday, if we have T and X, and let's say we have some event here, which is some positive t and x equals 0. Then in other boosted frames, The same event will have different values in x and t, but they'll all lie on that hyperboloid where t squared minus x squared, or in this case, the hyperbola where t squared minus x squared is constant. So the analogy is with rotations in two dimensions, where, once again, I can imagine I have some point, but depending on my reference frame, in this case just under rotations, I will ascribe different coordinates to that point. But there's something everybody will agree on, which is what the length of the vector is. Okay? So rotations leave x squared plus y squared invariant. So we think about the rotations as linear transformations on the vector xy that leave the length invariant. Leave x squared plus y squared invariant. Lorentz transformations are linear transformations on t and x that leave the Lorentzian length invariant that leaves t squared minus x squared invariant. So they differ by this little minus sign, which makes all the interesting difference in the world, of course. So this is the sense in which we have space-time. They can be rotated into each other, just analogously how x and y can be rotated into each other, although it's not quite as close as x and y because there is that minus sign after all. Okay. So time is different than space, but they are definitely mixed. They're mixed under Lorentz transformations. Okay. Yes?
It's kind of a technical point, but the hyperbola that you drew, that
yes.
would be the active transformation, the orbit of the active transformation, rather
than... I'm not talking about active. At the moment, I'm just the whole discussion of active-passive transformations is very confusing. So I prefer not to even use that language. I'm just talking about there are transformations on this. There's something very concrete. There are transformations on these on t and x that leave t squared minus x squared invariant. We'll call those Lorentz transformations. Right. Yeah.
Do you mean that in your second picture it looks like you're rotating your axes from the first picture? You're not changing your axes. You're changing.
Sorry. That's right. Exactly. Sorry. So I treated the two of them differently. You're right. Thank you. But yeah, so if I didn't draw the picture, the equations are identical. All right, so let's maybe many of you have seen Lorentz transformations written as x prime is gamma x minus vt and something. So the first thing to do is to get rid of these gammas and v's. So we talk about them like adults. Okay. So let's actually go back to rotations and remember how you talk about rotations like adults. What is x prime? I mean, explicitly, x prime is x cos theta minus y sine theta, and y prime is y cos theta plus x sine theta. Okay? So that's an explicit linear transformation on x and y that gives me the rotated points. And you trivially verify that x prime squared plus y prime squared is equal to x squared plus y squared. What's the even more adult way of talking about that? So you don't have to think about this stupid mixture. Whenever you have any symmetry at all, your first instinct should be to make it act as simply as possible. Okay? To figure out what its action is, choose variables so the action of the symmetry is as simple as humanly possible. And we're still not done yet. That's not as simple as humanly possible. There's a minus sign, there's cosines and sines, it's always confusing. What are the variables that make the action of the rotations as simple as humanly possible? Well, we introduce z as x plus iy. Okay. Then x squared plus y squared is just z star z. Okay. And the action of rotations is now just z goes to e to the I theta z, and z star goes like e to the negative I theta z star. Right? So these are the variables which make it dead manifest and obvious what rotations are. Okay. Of course, from here, you just expand z is x plus I y, you expand e to the I theta as cos theta plus I sine theta, and you immediately arrive at that equation. Okay. But these are the more fundamental, slightly more fundamental variables on which rotations act nicely. Yes?
Can can only use this strategy using complex numbers if we are in two dimensions.
That's right. So I'm just talking about two dimensions for now, but we'll talk about the more general situation in a bit. A final interesting thing, there's actually one last simple set of variables that we can talk about that make the action of rotations even simpler. In order to do that, let's actually talk not about this invariant length of a vector, but let's talk about just the infinitesimal distance between two points. So if I have two points, x, y, and x plus delta x, y plus delta y, then it's nice to talk about the invariant distance, the infinitesimal distance, ds squared between those two points, right? And ds squared is just dx squared, so let's call this dx, dy. Okay. Ds squared is just dx squared plus dy squared. Okay. So it's just flat space. We're not doing any curved stuff for the moment. It's just I'm just writing the flat space metric. Okay. Just dx squared plus dy squared. I can also write this as dz times dz star, or dz star times dz. And there's a final set of Comedian variables that make the action of rotations obvious, which is what? The last very familiar set of ways of talking about the rotations in a point. Polar coordinates, right? So I get polar coordinates by writing z as r e to the I phi, let's say. And then the action of rotations is then just r is unchanged and phi is just shifted by theta. Okay, so that's amazingly simple. And in these coordinates, the s squared is dr squared plus r squared d phi squared. And you see that the fact that this distance, infinitesimal distance, is invariant under Lorentz transformation, invariant under rotations, is here just trivially the fact that this is invariant under shifting phi goes to phi plus constant. Okay. All right? So I'm just reminding you about very simple things about standard rotations. So let's go back here and repeat the same exercises for Lorentz transformation. Actually easier for Lorentz transformation because there aren't eyes wandering around here. So let's start off again. So we have t prime squared minus x prime squared is equal to t squared minus x squared. That's what we're looking for. We're looking for transformations that do that. So let's define x plus minus to be t plus minus x. Just the exact analog of x plus iy, except there's no I. Now, Lorentz transformations are the statement that x plus prime, x minus prime, should equal x plus x minus. So what is the action of... So that's extremely simple now, right? What are Lorentz transformations? Lorentz transformations are something that... rescale x minus and x plus by the opposite amount to leave the product invariant. Okay. So they're just x plus prime is e to the eta x plus and x minus prime is e to the minus eta x minus. Okay. So I'm not using theta anymore, e to the I theta, I'm using eta. Eta will end up being related to the V and gammas and all that stuff, but we're writing it in a nicer way. Okay. So these are Lorentz transformations. Now, just as before, you can figure out what the action is on the T and X. Okay, I can, so if I add these two equations, this tells me that t prime plus x prime is e to the eta t plus x,
and t prime minus x prime is e to the negative eta t minus x. So I can solve for t prime. So t prime is cosh eta t plus sinh eta x, and x prime is cosh eta x plus sinh eta t. So these are the Lorentz transformations in one plus one dimensions, written in a nicer way than with gammas and root one minus b squares and b and stuff like that. As a trivial exercise, just translate this to the form that you're maybe more familiar with gammas and things like that. There's a simple form of the relation to gamma, write it in the familiar form. But this is a way of writing it to make it just dead manifest that it's just like rotations. It's coshes and sinches replacing cosines and sines. But this is even the nicer way of thinking about it, directly in terms of these variables, x plus and x minus. All right, well, there is, of course, a very important difference between rotations and the Lorentz transformations, and that's related to the fact that the invariant distance can have either sign. It can be positive, it can be zero, which corresponds to what the light rays travel along, or it could be negative. For ordinary rotations, you just have one, everything is just positive. Here we have three distinct possibilities. The invariant length is positive, zero, or negative. And it's associated with something very important physically, that in any space time, there are regions that may or may not be, and you need to decide, causally connected from each other, where light rays can, in principle, transmit information from one region to another. Let's just go back to this very simple picture of Minkowski space. Okay, so here's T and X, one plus one dimensional Minkowski space. These are our friends, the 45 degree lines. Okay. So for instance, if I'm here, any signal turned on here, anything done here, a bomb goes off here, anything happens here, it's only going to affect things that are inside its future light cone. Okay? Anything that happens there will only affect what goes on in there. There's no way that something that's happening there can have any influence on something that's happening out there. This region, this entire upper quadrant, is totally causally disconnected from anything that can happen here. I could be an observer walking around here. Here I am walking around, okay? Nothing can get to me. Of course, let's say something goes off here, and I'm just sitting at rest here. I'm sitting at rest, sitting at rest, sitting at rest. Of course, if I cross that line, then I will eventually get the information by going inside that region. But there are some set of observers who may, for perverse reasons, want to always stay inside on this side. Okay? Those observers will never see anything from this side. So that's possible. It's possible for there to be regions of space-time that you can never get information from. Let's actually think a little bit about what that funny observer might be. What does it take in order to actually always stay on this side? What do you have to do? Let's say you're just like moving along for now. What do you have to do to avoid crossing over in there? I have to start moving away, right? I have to start trying to move away. And in order to actually avoid crossing in, I've got to move away so that eventually I'm moving basically at the speed of light, right? Because if I'm not moving at the speed of light, I'll eventually have a slope that's steeper than 45 degrees and I'll go in. So I have to do something pretty drastic. I have to move away from this region and move away constantly so that I'm asymptotically moving away with the speed of light. Okay. But And so I can do that just by constantly accelerating away from that point. There's that point x equals 0 there, just a point in space, and I'm constantly accelerating away from it. I'm accelerating away with some constant acceleration. I eventually hit the speed of light. But that guy will never see any information from the region with x less than 0. Yes?
But I guess that that point where the event is happening is moving in time as well, so it's going away too?
No, that's fine. I mean, the event happened here. A light bulb goes off here. Okay, something happens there. Anything that happens there is only going to affect things inside that region. If this thing goes off and does something else later, then that'll affect what happens in there. But none of that information ever gets out. I'm stressing this basic thing because there's a lot of very important physics associated with the fact that there are regions of space-time. You see, here, by choice, there are regions of space-time which certain kinds of observers will not see what's going on. Okay. But there are other observers that can. What happens in the context of things like black holes and things like an accelerating universe, in those two situations, there are horizons where, by no choice, there are regions of space where if you simply stay outside without doing anything very crazy, you just stay very far away, you'll never get information from what's going on. You'll never get information about what's going on behind that horizon. That's the case of the black hole. In the case of an accelerating universe, simply in any given observer in an accelerating universe, there are regions in the universe will never get information from those regions. These horizons are incredibly important and interesting things. But what's fascinating is that a lot of the basic physics of them can already be understood from this simple Minkowski space example. In fact, let's actually see this a little more precisely. Let's see this a little more precisely by finishing our little analog with rotations. Let's talk about the nicest coordinates, the analog of polar coordinates here. Okay, so again, I would write df squared as dt squared minus dx squared. I could write this as dx plus dx minus. That's exactly the same way. And now I can write x plus is, instead of r and phi, let me call them rho e to the tau, and x minus is rho e to the negative tau. That's nice because Lorentz transformation acts by keeping rho to rho, but just shifting tau. Tau goes to tau plus eta under Lorentz transformation. And what is the metric? The metric is just rho squared d tau squared minus d rho squared. Just a perfect analog of dr squared plus r squared d theta squared. Dr squared plus r squared d phi squared. This is minus d rho squared plus rho squared d tau squared. Tau was like the angle before, and rho was like the radius before. Okay?
So why now you can only vary tau?
Sorry?
You can't vary rho now?
Well, no. So it's just like before. This is the action under Lorentz transformations. So under a Lorentz transformation, rho is invariant and tau is shifted. Just like under rotations, r was invariant and theta was shifted. Phi was shifted. So that's just the action of the Lorentz transformation on these coordinates. Okay. So beautiful. This way of talking about the metric of Minkowski space. These are called Rindler coordinates. And already we start seeing some of the salient differences from rotations. Rotations, dr squared plus r squared d theta squared, or those coordinates r and theta, let me say it more precisely. The coordinates r and theta actually cover the entire plane. Right? I can get to anywhere on the plane from any point x, y on the plane is associated with some r and theta. Okay. Not the case here. Not the case here. These coordinates are actually not covering all of Minkowski space. Can anyone tell me why? Yeah?
They're less positive.
Well, right. So for example, these guys are always positive. But let me say it even more invariantly. The product x plus x minus, which is Lorentz invariant, is rho squared, which is positive. Okay. So I'm only covering that region of Minkowski space where x plus x minus is a positive number. Which region is that?
The right one? The top?
That's actually... Oh, actually, I should have... thank you. So let me put a minus sign in front of one of them. We could cover either one, but the one I wanted to cover is this one. So we're covering the region where x plus x minus is negative, okay? And actually, we could do it either way. That's fine. So the one I've written here is only covering where x plus x minus is positive. So x plus x minus is positive is this region and that region. I could choose a different set of coordinates that would cover the other side. Okay. Yeah.
Don't you like?
Because the Minkowski space is a manifold.
Yeah.
Don't you like have to cover the entire manifold with the charge?
No. Even the simplest situation of just a circle. A circle can't be covered with a single charge.
Oh, yeah, but so, I mean, you need an atlas for the manifold to be a manifold.
True. So this is just covering a region. It's just a metric on a region.
Yeah, okay.
And we'll come back to exactly what it's telling us in a second. But actually, so let's go back. And what I really wanted to talk about is the other region. So remember, I think I defined x plus minus to be t plus minus x. I should have done it as x plus minus t. Anyway, that's fine. So if I put a minus sign in front of if I put a minus sign in front of these guys, in fact, let me say negative x minus to be this, then I'm talking about the other region. Okay. Then I'm talking about this region. Now let's actually ask. What these coordinates a little more physically what they mean. Let's say I'm sitting at a constant rho and different taus. Okay. Constant rho and different taus give me a picture that looked like that, right? In fact, it's really easy because constant rho, the different taus, are just given by taking that point and boosting it, right? So if this is some rho, then this just labels the different taus. Tau equals 1, 2, 3, whatever, in whatever units, minus 1, minus 2, etc. Okay. Say this is rho equals 4. Okay. Some particular value of rho and different values of tau. We can get an even better physical idea by looking at what x of tau looks like right in the neighborhood around here. See, right in the neighborhood around there as well. So let's just physically see what this looks like. This is something which is moving towards, at minus infinity, tau equals minus infinity is moving towards here, x equals 0. It's moving towards that boundary at the speed of light. And then it's slowing down. Right at this point, it's stopped, and then it's turning around and heading back out and going to a velocity of infinity away from x equals 0, right? So if you're an observer with constant rho and different tau's, You're coming in from minus infinity with the speed of light, decelerating, coming to rest, distance rho away from x equals 0, and then you're accelerating away, back away again. It's actually easy to see that you're moving with a constant acceleration. And what should your acceleration be, do you think? So this is an exercise that you can work out. I mean, you can work out in detail, but it's another one of the dimensional analysis, instant dimensional analysis things. What should the acceleration be? What are the units of acceleration? The units of acceleration are distance over time squared, which is 1 over time, or 1 over distance. Right? So what should the acceleration be? What do you think the acceleration of this observer is? It's 1 over rho. That's all it can be. So it's actually moving with an acceleration 1 over rho. Makes sense, right? As rho gets bigger and bigger, these hyperbolas are getting flatter and flatter. Right? As rho as rho goes out bigger and bigger, the hyperbolas are getting flatter and flatter. So that's a really crappy hyperbola. But so clearly, they're accelerating less and less as you move further and further out. So these coordinates cover this region of Minkowski space. If you like, also that region, but that region would be for negative rho. Okay? For positive rho, just covers that region. Negative rho covers that region. And then flipping the sign back here, positive rho would cover that region, and negative rho would cover that region. Okay? So this is something new that happens in Minkowski space that we don't have for ordinary rotations, the possibility of horizons. And that's deeply tied to the causal structures, because there is causal structure. There's meaning to different signs of ds squared. Okay. This observer can never see anything happening to the left of x equals 0 anywhere. Forget just up there, right? Anything happening over here will never affect any, will never affect any of these. Now, how do we see? You asked the question of, don't we want a metric that covers everything? And it's true. The nice Minkowski coordinates, the standard coordinates, the t squared minus dx squared, or dx plus dx minus even, any of those coordinates cover all of Minkowski space. Actually, those coordinates make another symmetry manifest. Remember, a big part of our story, another general slogan that I've mentioned a number of times, is try to make the symmetries you're interested in as manifest as possible. Okay. A caveat to that, or something to remember, is it's not always possible to make all the symmetries simultaneously manifest. And you should realize that and pick and choose whichever ones are most convenient for you at any given time. Let's actually pause for a second and ask what we've lost by using these coordinates and working with these variables. There is a symmetry which is very obvious when you write the metric as dt squared minus dx squared, which is not being made manifest here. What is it?
Translations,
exactly. Okay. Overall translations are trivially a symmetry, again, just because dx and dt are trivially invariant under translations. Okay. So translations are wonderful in those coordinates. The Lorentz transformations are also pretty obvious, but they're not as obvious as they are with these coordinates. Okay. But these coordinates are sacrificing manifest translational invariants. Okay. Translations don't act nicely in these coordinates. We picked an origin. Right? We made the point. We picked an origin just like we did for rotations. Okay. I want to say something else about this. Oh right. So, but how do we see then? How do we see that there's something wrong? But how do we see that there's a piece of the space missing? Here we drew this picture. Here we started this global picture of the Minkowski space and decided to focus on a part of it. And we got, and we just went through these trivial exercises to get the metric. But let's say someone had just handed you this metric. How would they know that there's something funny? How would they know there's something going wrong? This metric becomes degenerate somewhere.
It becomes degenerate when rho equals 0.
Okay.
At rho equals 0, this doesn't look like a two-dimensional metric anymore. It just looks like a one-dimensional metric. Right? It should be a two-dimensional space, but the metric is becoming degenerate. The metric has a what we would call a coordinate singularity. Just like r equals 0 is a coordinate singularity. Okay? This is the coordinate singularity of this metric. The presence of rho equals 0, I should have said, rho equals 0 is obviously this light cone, right? That's rho equals 0. Okay. So rho equals 0, where the coefficient, so tau is like time in these coordinates, right? Rho equals 0 is like,
did you mean that?
Sorry?
You mean ds equals 0?
No, in these coordinates, if rho is equal, so the points where rho equals 0 are exactly these guys. Rho equals 0 is the entire hyperbola, okay? Because that's where x plus x minus equals 0, okay? Where t squared minus x squared equals 0. Okay? So rho equals 0 is this entire edge of the light line. And so you see from these coordinates that that's a horizon because the coefficient of the time part of the metric is vanishing there. Okay, so when the coefficient of the time part of the metric is vanishing, that's the signal of the presence of a horizon. Okay? That's exactly what happens also in black hole metric. And it's also what happens in appropriate ways of thinking about it in the de Sitter literature. As we'll talk about later. But so that's the signal. The signal is the coefficient of the time part of the metric vanishing. Yes.
Is it good time for coffee break soon?
Yeah, let me just make one more comment and then we can have the coffee break. Now this is a coordinate singularity, not a physical singularity. And here you can very easily see why. First of all, there is this underlying Minkowski space. So we have a set of coordinates that cover everything. Okay? And we derived it from it. Secondly, even if you weren't smart enough to see that, you could actually compute something invariant, like the curvature associated with this metric. And of course you'd find that it's flat. The curvature is 0. Okay? So there's all sorts of crazy ways of writing flat space with 0 curvature, with coordinates that have singularities, all sorts of junk. It doesn't matter. It's a coordinate artifact. It's just telling you that your coordinate system is breaking down there, not that anything physical is happening. But that's a very good signal of the presence of a horizon. It's a universal signal of the coefficient of the time part of the metric is vanishing. And that place is a place that is a boundary between regions which are and aren't causally connected. Okay. So there's a great formal similarity between Lorentz transformations and rotations, but there's a big physical difference is that there is causality in time, and its most dramatic manifestation is the presence of horizon. This little phenomenon that we talked about is dead universal. Okay? If you have any black object, any horizon, almost every horizon with one kind of exception, for example, a Schwarzschild black hole. Close enough to the horizon of a Schwarzschild black hole, the metric looks exactly like this. Always. So this behavior is dead universal. And understanding what goes on in this situation, which we'll come back to, I think, in the fourth lecture, is going to give us a lot of insight into what horizons mean, what they do, and why they are important. Okay. But at the moment, it's just a kinematic fact of appreciating this very big important difference between Lorentzian and Euclidean space. Okay, great. We'll come back and keep going with some discussions of special relativity.